what exactly this story that I tell in the book says about the 1940s in terms of why they matter to the history of human rights in a broader framework. And so in this paper, I go through kind of three arguments about the way in which this period kind of sheds light on this history. First is the role of the larger question about the relationship between the United States and human rights. And this is often framed, particularly in the 1940s, as this this period between 1941, between Franklin Roosevelt's Four Freedoms speech, and then Eleanor Roosevelt's lovely presentation in a smaller picture here of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So we have the seeds planted by Franklin, harvested by Eleanor. And this often figures in the narrative as this golden age of American support for human rights, that it's grounded in this great tradition begun by Franklin, shepherded by Roosevelt, but then it falls away, that something happens along the way, and we enter this stage in which the American relationship with human rights is now being sardonically by people like Michael Ignatieff as exceptional. Right, that we accept ourselves from participation in the UN human rights system. We don't sign treaties. We don't become active participants in the overall UN structure. We highlight the abuses of our geopolitical foes while ignoring the abuses of our allies. And that part of what needs to happen is a kind of return to this golden age, this commitment. And some of this is a political argument for a renewed engagement with left liberalism. But I also think that this story is inadequate. And so I think a close attention to the 1940s reveals the much more complicated way in which the rise of the United States as a global power in the world, as a potential hegemonic global power in the world, was tied to human rights. And so I look in particular not so much at the work of the Roosevelts, but at the work of American NGOs. The Commission to Study the Organization of the Peace is a seminal organization, horrible name, but nevertheless incredibly important. And also the work of groups like the NAACP and the ABA, in which human rights provides a framework for civil society organizations to engage the process of American international life in a new and more robust way. And so the CSOP is the one who develops the human rights proposals that eventually make it into the charter, and it's through their particular research, lobbying directly with the Roosevelt administration, and then broader advocacy work with the American public that makes this issue, that really tees up San Francisco and allows it to appear. The stories of the NAACP and the ABA are slightly different, right? The NAACP takes up the UN human rights system immediately after San Francisco as a way of attempting to address the failure of the U.S. national system to address the problem of racial injustice and to articulate a connection between the struggles of African Americans domestically and the struggles of anti-colonial activists abroad, and the ABA in exactly the opposite direction. They too see this as a critical corrective or a critical change in the U.S. national system. It's one to be resisted rather than reinforced. And so they push very hard for a disengagement with the UN human rights system, marking it as essentially foreign, as essentially socialistic, as essentially anti-American. And so these are critical drivers. The NGO community or the civil society activists are the critical drivers of American human rights policy right from the beginning. It's not this Roosevelt centric narrative. I also look in particular at the work of two Asian diplomats, Charles Malik, as we've said, from Lebanon, and Carlos Romulo from the Philippines. Both of whom attended the San Francisco conference, both of whom were charter members of the Commission on Human Rights, and both of whom are represented in the literature as having been extremely important to the development of the UN human rights system. And that's certainly the case, but it's also certainly the case that they're often represented as authentic, well, either authentic or inauthentic representatives of a particular third world voice. And that's, I also think, an inadequate way of understanding them. They're neither simply westernized patsies, nor are they the voice of the subaltern. Rather, they engage the discussion on human rights. They attempt to build the UN human rights system as a way to both foster, channel, and direct U.S. influence in the world. So once again, we see that this language emerges precisely as a way of negotiating U.S. power in some way. So you get Carlos Romulo, who deliberately tries to make the UN human rights system an overtly anti-colonial system. At the same time, he's proclaiming that it's in full keeping with U.S. traditions of decolonization, holding up the Philippines as a so-called pattern by which the rest of the world can be decolonized. I'll skip ahead on the details, which I'm sure all of you, we all beautifully read it, I'm sure. But the other two questions that I think this thing, this period gets us to is one about this, and this has to do with the subject of the conference, is the broad continuity of history, the continuity and change in the 20th century history of human rights. Because certainly 1948 is not the moment of inception, but neither is 1976, right? We don't, it's not that Loren is correct, Paul Gordon Loren's text, that human rights stretch back into antiquity, but neither is it correct to say that true human rights only emerges with Helsinki Watch or something along these lines. It's a much more convoluted and less linear narrative than that. And I think that the 1940s represent this crucial pivot point in which pre-war projects, pre-war assumptions were transformed, but also continued through their engagement with the UN human rights discourse. So.